think we'll go ahead and begin. My name is Jenny Bouvier. I'm here at the Jennings Randolph Senior Fellowship Program, and I'd like to welcome you all to the Institute today. This is the last in this series of project reports by the fellows. And today, Senior Fellow Abakir Mukhtar will give his project report on the fringes of Northern identity, what's missing in the Darfur peace process. Since mid-2003, attacks by Sudanese government forces and allied militia have led to the deaths of over 200,000 and the displacement of 2 million Darfurians. Despite the deployment of the African Union mission in Sudan in 2004, and after 7 rounds of peace talks led to an agreement in May 2005, the security situation in Darfur continues to deteriorate. Dr. Mukhtar will discuss the context and concerns about the peace process in Darfur and discuss the role of marginalized identities as both a root cause of the conflict and a potential spoiler of an already fragile peace process. Today's report is part of a larger book project in which Dr. Mukhtar is engaged that reinterprets the history of Sudan and the decades of conflict in that country through the prism of identity and identity politics. He's pioneering new terrain that will have direct implications for the long-term resolution of that conflict, and we're pleased to have been able to support him with a fellowship this past year. Abakir has been a wonderful resource for the Institute. He's been generous with his time and his analysis, both in-house and in the broader Washington community. Abakir's presence has been critical to shaping USIP's on-the-ground efforts, particularly in the education program and 2 training programs we conducted in Sudan this last year. Abakir Mukhtar is Regional Campaign Coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa region for the International Secretariat of Amnesty International. He previously served as a refugee project manager in the Family Support Unit of the Babini Center for Young People in Manchester, United Kingdom, and was a consultant to Human Rights Watch on Sharia law. Dr. Mukhtar has taught in various positions, including Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at Manchester Metropolitan University, in the Department of English at the University of Jazeera, Sudan, and as a secondary school teacher of English in Sudan. He holds a PhD in Middle Eastern Studies, Human Rights, and Islamic Law from the University of Manchester, a Master's of Science in Teaching English from Aston University in Birmingham, and a Master's of Education in Curriculum Studies from the University of Khartoum in Sudan. A few additional items before Dr. Mukhtar begins. First, I'd like to thank Cheryl Simmons, a doctoral student from the ICAR program at George Mason University, who's been serving as Dr. Mukhtar's research assistant and who's been key and instrumental in organizing today's event. Thank you, Cheryl. And I'd also like to thank Mandy Laisu, who's not in the room today, but she's a master's candidate in international affairs at George Washington, and she assisted in preparing the PowerPoint presentation that we'll be seeing. Secondly, for the media in the room, I offer our usual disclaimer that the speaker's views do not necessarily represent those of the United States Institute of Peace, which does not advocate specific policies. Third, this event is being recorded live and will be available later from the USIP website. And finally, I would ask that you turn off your cell phones. They will interfere not only with the event, but with the taping and the microphones in the room, so they'll cause a disturbance if you don't turn them off now. And now, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Abakir Mukhtar.
Thanks, Virginia, for your introduction, and I would like to start by expressing my thanks and gratitude to the USIP Fellowship Program for giving me this great opportunity in a very stimulating environment to read, think, reflect, write, and talk. Activities that I really enjoy doing. My thanks also go to all the people in the USIP. I just pick up a few. Sharon Brown, Don Priest, Virginia, who will be my program officer. Sheila. Sheila, Erin, for all the support that they lend me. I would also like to thank Peter Babilionis, my editor, for his insightful comments on the drafts that I gave him. I would also like to thank Dan Sirwa for his program support. My thanks Well, to all those I work with in the other programs and business design working group, I'm indebted to them all. Finally, I would like to thank my research assistant, Shirley Simmons, for her help and support, and also Amanda for helping with the PowerPoint. Now, before I start my talk, I want to say something about subjectivity and objectivity. Some of my colleagues who belong to the ethnicities that are part of the conflict that they were writing about made a point that there was a degree of unavoidable subjectivity in their research. Well, I don't want to follow their suit. I can make a big claim to objectivity in my project. I belong to the northern ethnic group in Sudan, and my research is critical, mainly critical of them and of their culture. So I belong to these groups. I do not identify with them or with what they did. I am not unique in this position, and many other northern Sudanese hold similar views. Now, let me move on to my talk, which is entitled On the Fringes of the Northern Identity, What's Missing in the Peace, Darfur Peace Process. Darfur has been very much in the news recently as a scene of the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. My point of departure will be the Darfur Peace Agreement. On the 5th of May 2006, under the auspices of the African Union, AU, the government of Sudan and the faction of the liberation of the Sudan Liberation Movement, led by Mini Arko Minawi, that's an AMM, this is because there is another faction that will be SAA something else, signed the Darfur Peace Agreement, the DPA. The SLA, led by Abdel Wahid Muhammad Nour, that I will call SLA AW. And the Justice and Equality Movement, JEM, refused to sign the agreement, arguing that it did not meet the minimum demands of the people of Darfur. Abdel Wahid demands that the implementation of the implementation modalities of security arrangements be strengthened through more involvement of his group. He also is also dissatisfied with the DPA's provisions for the victims' compensation fund, and also for the political representation of his group. JEM, on the other hand, is dissatisfied with the protocol on power and wealth sharing. The movement maintains that the DPA does not adequately address the conflict's root causes, namely the structural inequities between the center and the marginalized regions. So the DPA was received with cautious and guarded welcome by local opposition parties in the country, by local, regional, and international NGOs, but wide sections of the people of Darfur rejected it outright. Opposition political parties called it a faulty agreement, but hoped that it would stop the war and lead to the deployment of a UN peacekeeping force to protect the people of Darfur. The International Crisis Group, ICG, called it fragile, stating that the document has serious flaws. The participants of the forum of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard on Sudan saving lives, sustaining peace, were unanimous in describing the peace process as imperfect, limited, and deeply flawed. UN Representative Jan Prong acknowledged, quote, the DPA is facing resistance on the ground, especially by refugees. He also said that violence in Darfur escalated after the signing of the agreement, admitted shortcomings in the document, I stated that it does not resonate with the people in that country. We call for additions to it to be supplemented. The government of Sudan objected to his proposal, saying that the DPA cannot be amended unless the realities on the ground change, referring to the ruling National Congress Party's doctrine of not responding to anything but force. So the DPA represents a unique case of a peace agreement that led to more conflict and increasing violence, death and displacement. It also led to more splits within the only rebel movement that signed it, the SLA-MA. Furthermore, it led to new political alliances. In order to transform themselves into a compelling force deserving Khartoum's respect, the movements that rejected the DPA formed and declared a new alliance called the National Redemption Front, NRF. The NRF is composed of those SLA commanders who split from Inami, calling themselves the Group of 19, GEM, and the Sudan Federal Democratic Alliance, FDA, led by veteran politician Ahmed Ibrahim Diray, who kept a distance from the rebels until the DPA was reached. The SLA, Abdel Wahid's faction, is not yet part of the NRF. The NRF claimed attacks on the town of Hamrat al-Sheikh, North Kordofan, opening a new front and taking the war outside Darfur. In the foundation declaration, the party said they wanted to deliver a message to the government of Sudan that they are a force that cannot be ignored, and that they are demanding a comprehensive peace in reference to the DPA shortcomings. They insist that the DPA does not meet the expectations of the people of Darfur, that it has been forced upon them, and that it only strengthens the position of the government. On the other hand, a new alliance has been between the government of Sudan and the SLA, the Maoist faction, emerged as a result of the DPA. This undeclared government of Sudan, SLA, the Maoist faction alliance, immediately carried out attacks against the other factions. These clashes displaced 8,000 civilians, according to the United Nations Emergency Coordinator, John Higland. Higland also mentioned that the government forces were reportedly supporting the attacks against the splinter faction and humanitarian workers throughout Darfur on almost a daily basis. He accused the government of Sudan of violating international principles by using white helicopters, the same color of the helicopters used by the African Union mission in Sudan, ANIS, and the United Nations, a matter which poses a direct threat to UN and non-governmental organization staff who are neutral and impartial and should not be attacked. All these developments led Jan Prong to declare that there is a significant risk that the DPA will collapse. The question then that pose themselves are, why did it turn out to be like that? Wherein lies the fault? Does it lie in the DPA or in those who rejected it? And finally, what will become of it? The answer to these questions, we need first to see the context in which the DPA was produced, to examine its contents, and to see what was missing before we see indications for the future. Now to go to the context. The circumstances surrounding the talks between of the peace process were chaotic, to say the least, leading to little and confused understanding of the problem. All the parties to the conflict, the rebels of Darfur and the government of Sudan, as well as the mediators, the African Union, the AU, the UN, and the US administration, had their own internal constraints and detriments. Some political scientists think that neither the rebels nor the government of Sudan were ready for an agreement due to the fluidity of the situation. The international attention did not come as a result of the rebels' achievements on the ground, but because of the humanitarian disaster crisis created by the government of Sudan's counterinsurgency campaign. Khartoum perceived the rebels as inexperienced amateurs who do not know how the international community operates and who naively sought to translate the international concern into political units. The rebels entered the talks with neither a unified gun nor a unified negotiating position. The SFA started as a credible and promising for the people of Darfur. Fashion after the Southern Rebel Movement, SPLA, SPLM, adopting its political discourse and New Sudan ideology, and aspiring to build a movement representative of all Darfur's ethnic groups, including the Arab tribes, the SLA attracted a number of intellectuals and experienced politicians among its leadership and represented a real worry for Khartoum. Whether it was the work of Khartoum or not, the split of the SLA into two factions dealt a devastating blow to the rebels' cause. The split weakened and sidelined the intellectuals and the political activists and led to the ascendancy of Mini Minawi, whose political experience and leadership qualities are rather limited. As a result of the split, the SLA lost its strong negotiator, Dr. Sherif Harir, who headed the negotiations team in the early rounds. This tipped the balance in favor of the government. Minawi's team was no match for Khartoum's team with diplomatic experience and negotiation skills. Sherif Harir was a professor of political science at Bergen University and the author of many publications, including his remarkable paper, Racism in Islamic Disguise, in which he firmly established the Darfur marginalization as a result of institutional racism, based on Northerners' assumed identity. Although Sherif Harir headed the SLA negotiations team on several occasions, his status within the movement appears to have been undermined after the split because he disappeared from the subsequent SLA negotiating teams. Popular with the international community, he was perceived by both Abdel Wahid and Minawi as a potential threat to their leadership. Sherif has much to offer to the Darfur cause, but it remains to be seen whether he can re-establish himself as a key player. The government of Sudan's counter-insurgency strategy was simple: to run a cheap proxy war, divide the rebel movement, drag its heels on negotiations to buy time, and to allow the Janjaweed to create new realities on the ground and lead a diplomatic offensive to avoid international intervention and prosecutions by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. The UN, despite the many strong utterances by Secretary General Kofi Annan, did not have a strategy to deal with the crisis in Darfur. It is constrained by its member states, especially in the developed world, who would encourage it to act without giving it the means to do so. Therefore, it is convenient for the UN to pass the catastrophe on to the newly reborn African Union, AU. For the AU, this is an opportunity to put its slogan, African Solutions to African Problems, into practice. This slogan has become, for the government of Sudan, the scarecrow that would fend off the international community from meddling in Darfur. As for the international community, the slogan became, as Gerard Prunier's puts it, the politically correct way of saying we don't care. The former president of the African Union, President Obasanjo, who was hosting the talks in Abuja, was keen to have an agreement for his own personal political ambitions. He needed a success in that effort to help him amend the Nigerian federal constitution in order to be able to run for a third term in office. He did exactly that. Soon after the signing of the DPA, he forwarded a motion to the parliament to amend the constitution, arguing that God would not want him to leave a good job unfinished. His motion was defeated. The US administration, especially once it had declared Darfur to be the scene of genocide, was under immense pressure from an array of public opinion elements to do something to protect the victims. On the other hand, Khartoum obviously had strong sympathizers within the CIA. Prunier tells us that, quote, the realists in the intelligence community kept insisting that Khartoum was too important to be harshly dealt with or treated. These contradictory pressures, Prunier maintains, led the White House to compromise on all fronts. The US administration's position to send a UN peacekeeping force under Chapter 7 to Darfur was further weakened within the Security Council by China and Russia. Both of them insist that the UN Security Council has to have the consent of the government of Sudan first before the UN can take a leading role in the conflict. A quick fix. For all these reasons, a quickly fixed agreement presented an optimal solution that would relieve all, and especially the US administration, from internal pressures and from the hurdles put forth by China and Russia. Attentively watching all the indicators, the ICG warned in October 2005 that the international community might act out of frustration. In its report, unifying that four rebels, a prerequisite for peace, the ICG said, quote, frustrated as it is, the international community would nevertheless make a mistake if it chose to, an appearance of stability to offer a comprehensive solution, since that would leave the root causes of the conflict untouched, despite hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions of displaced. This prophecy came true. As was expected, the mediators acted out of discretion and applied uneven pressure on the parties to the conflict, with the rebel movements receiving the bigger share of the pressure. Fractioned, weak, inexperienced, and with limited negotiating skills, the rebel became the vulnerable party. As soon as Khartoum declared that it accepted the AU's compromise document, which was a precursor to the DPA, senior diplomats, including U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zulik and others, descended on Abuja. The mediators applied pressure on the insurgent leaders, especially Mini Minawi, to sign. Mini succumbed to the pressure and signed the agreement, only to declare the following day that he signed under pressure, and his signature rocked his movement, and leading to a number of splits, the major among them the split led by the group of 19. The contents. The DPA consists of three protocols on power sharing, wealth sharing, and security arrangements, as well as a chapter laying out the framework for a Darfur dialogue consultation. The DPA's weakness reflect the circumstances in which it was born. According to the ICG report, the parties were unevenly matched in diplomatic experience. The rebels lacked a common position. Key members of their delegations were often absent. I summarize here some of the concerns about the BPA that have been enumerated elsewhere, particularly by the ICD. Namely, the language of the BPA is often vague. It defers dealing with vital issues such as wealth sharing. It fails to include implementation modalities. It lacks guarantees for disarmament of the Janjaweed militias or for the voluntary and safe return of the refugees and the IDPs. There are no provisions for accountability for the many heinous crimes that have occurred. In addition, key parties to the conflict did not cite the SLA and the right faction and gang, and also key elements in the problem, the Arab tribes, were not part of the peace process and were not present at the table. In its response to the ICG critique, the African Union accused the ICG of misrepresentation of the DP. But reading through their response, one finds that the AU offered a rather elaborate justification for the weaknesses of the DPA, rather than actually pointing out concrete instances of misrepresentation or oversight in the ICG report. The AU indicated that the DPA reflected the power balance on the ground which allegedly favored the government of Sudan, and reminded us of an elementary reality that sometimes appears to be lost on some commentators, which is the fact that the movement did not win a military victory and were therefore not in a position to impose their terms on the government of Sudan. On the contrary, the rebel movement were fragmented and lacked capacity, said the AU. The AU response also stated that from the outset, the mediators felt the process excluded major stakeholders in the accord, and this is why they could put down the suggested the chapter 4, therefore, dialogue as a supplementary process to the DP. However, one of the positive aspects of the DPA is that it dealt with the land issue. It established an independent land commission for the accord to address the competition over land between the nomads and the sedentary farmers. However, the challenges facing this commission are enormous. First, it has to confront the expansionist agenda of the Arab tribes to appropriate land in Darfur. Second, it has to face environmental issues. Perpetuation of the current situation is obviously convenient to the Arab tribes who have a vested interest in the IDPs staying where they are now. The Arab gathering at the Jammu al-Arabi, which came into being in Darfur in 1986, is explicit in its plans to control the land of and people of Darfur. In the same year, 1986, during Sadiq al-Mahdi's premiership, 23 Darfur leaders of Arab extraction, a mix of mainstream intellectuals and tribal figures and senior officials, they wrote a memo to the Prime Minister. In that memo, they provided figures that exaggerate the size of the Arab tribes in Darfur, and the land, they also exaggerated the land they occupy, and their contribution to the country's national economy and cultural welfare. For instance, the memo claims that the Arabs comprise 70% of Darfur's population, and occupy 55% of Darfur's land, contribute 15% to the national income, and account for 40% of the educated elite of Darfur. In light of these figures, the signatories of the memo demanded that Arab tribes be given 50% of the positions at all levels of government. In recognition, quote, of their demographic weight, contribution to the generation of wealth and knowledge in the region, and historic role as bearers of civilization. The memo attributed to the Arab race the creation of civilization in this region and in areas of governance, religion, and language. While the Arab gathering sees their race as bearers of civilization and knowledge. They perceive the Zubda race, or the African tribes, as people of lower humanoid, of non-Arab ancestry, uncivilized, and semi-pagans who deserve to be enslaved. Leaders of the Zubda tribes in Darfur warned Khartoum of these, the activities of the Arab Bedouins, but their warning went unheeded. The signing of the CPA and the expectation that it may bring radical changes in the power structure in the whole country, and that this change may be at the expense of the dominating Arabic Islamic groups, sent shockwaves into the Arab gathering. Therefore, it moved to exploit its alliance with hardliners in the Islamist government in Khartoum, and to settle once and for all a long-standing conflict over land with Zubda tribes in Darfur. Now the Janjaweed depopulated the Zubda tribes. They also created new realities on the ground by settling in some of these of the villages and around most of the others, in what looks like the first step in the Arab Gathering's plan for a land grab. The next step for them is to transform the current situation into a permanent arrangement. The Land Commission had to face this serious challenge. The second serious challenge for the Land Commission relates to the relationship between human beings and their environment. The Land Commission has to find a way by which environmentally exhausted land might accommodate the needs of both nomads and farmers. Unless long-term environmental measures are put in place to reverse the desertification process, and unless the Arab tribes undergo some cultural change with regard to their way of life, so that they will have fewer animals, things will never improve and the problem will remain. The roots of the problem, identity. The central focus of my project is primarily on what I consider the root causes of the war, namely the identity-based marginalization of the whole region in relation to the central government. Probably the biggest weakness in the agreement is that it left the issue of identity and institutional racism untouched. According to Atal Bastani, this is the head department of the political science and leading political scientist in Sudan, still working at the University of Khartoum. To him, the current regime is not only Islamist, but also Arab-centric. He added that the regime injected an ideological and racist dimension to the conflict, with the sides defining themselves now as Arabs and Zubda. The participants of the Harvard Kennedy School of Governments Forum agreed that any solution must take into account the Sudan's identity issue and the crimes perpetrated in identity's name. This is really the root cause of the problem in the whole country. Naturally, the government of Sudan has vested interest in overlooking the issue of identity in Darfur peace process. But what is surprising is that the rebel movement did not insist that identity be the basis of the peace process. The ethnic composition of Darfur. Abdullah Usman Atom, this is a professor of anthropology from Darfur, from the Zubda tribes. He describes a process of identification in Darfur that is very similar to the process of identification in the Liberian North. A number of ethnic groups, the majority of which are black African Muslims, inhabit Darfur. Some of these groups still retain their original African languages but use Arabic as a lingua franca. Others have long lost their indigenous languages, have been speaking Arabic as their mother tongue, and have identified with the Arabs. However, there is a major division between black African ethnic groups, or the so-called Zulbia tribes, regardless of whether they speak Arabic as a mother tongue on the one hand, and the Arab tribes on the other hand. Among the Zulbia tribes are the four: the Masalit, the Zawawa, the Salamat, the Wetob, and the Parti. Among the Arab tribes are the Baggara, and there is the Gar, the Yadia, the Ma'aliya, and the Beni Halwa. The process of Arabization in Darfur. Since the 19th century, when the Fung king Badr III issued a royal decree announcing that he and his folk descended from the Arabs, and indeed from the Umayyads, all ethnic groups in this part of the world knew that claims to Arabic and Islamic identity would help him, would help bring them closer to the power circles and the accompanying privileges. As a result, now almost all the ethnic groups in the geographical north of Sudan have made claims to Arab pedigree. Abdullah Usman Atom tells us that many of the Zulbia tribes had also made claims to the Arab descent, or to Arab descent. He says, I quote, "Some of these groups who profess Arab connections in Darfur still retain their African languages, while others have lost theirs to Arabic in the last century or two. Examples here are the Zawawa, the Four, and the Parti, the Salamat, and the Meto, to mention but a few. Claims of these groups to Arab ancestry are often accompanied by written pedigrees codifying their ancestral link with either the Prophet Muhammad or with his close associates. Sometimes these pedigrees build authentication stamps, both in Saudi Arabia. Incredible as it may be, there are now commercial offices in Saudi Arabia trading in verification of these pedigrees." End of quote. Indeed, this passage is very enlightening. It shows that the process of identification with the Arabs that had been completed in the riverian north, or the political north, is still working in the geographical north. The new development is that now the riverian north, which is lurking on the margins of the Arab identity, has become the center of identity for Darfur and the other regions. The riverian north now has the power to grant or deny recognition of the margins claims. The process of Arabization among the Zulbia tribes, according to Atom, had been interrupted by the war in Darfur. Both the center and the peripheries are now forced to review their convictions. Atom tells us that some of the Zulbia tribes in Darfur, who claim to be Arabs, are now doing some rethinking. He states the following: Surprisingly, many groups speaking Arabic as their mother tongue and have, at least until a few years ago, courted both Arab ancestry and culture. For the latter category, Africanism has finally superseded language, Islam, as the influence of Arabic culture, as a determining factor of identity. For them, Africanism connotes both historic belonging to the land and pride in their darker color, but above all, distinctiveness from their new Arab opponents. Indeed, if this passage proved true, it indicates that the scene is set for a shift of identity, and that these groups have started to reconstruct their identities. These groups now feel that they are not allowed to be the people that they wanted to be, or in other words, they feel that the sense of identity that they aspire to be is not legitimizing their claims. Therefore, these tribes, which have undergone a process of Arabization to the extent of losing their own tongue to Arabic and foregoing their real ancestors to Arab ones purchased from salesmen in Saudi Arabia, have now begun to reveal their identities. Adnan continues to tell us that the current crisis has changed all previous populations' categorizations. It precipitated a new division that operates as an ideology that is consciously enacted on the ground as an arbiter of alliance among various ethnic groups. Therefore, can now be primarily divided into two broad categories. Arabs, mostly, but not all nomads, who have a strong claim to Arab culture and ancestry, and Black Africans, Zurga, who regard themselves as essentially non-Arab and African in origin. So, if this is the case, why didn't the peace process involve serious considerations of identity? Clause 107E of the DPA refers to this shyly as the recognition of social and cultural diversity. But it does not say how this recognition translates into policies on the ground. When Article 14 mentions education, it dealt with quantity, not quality of education of that form. It did not mention the content of education or who lays down the educational policies and the curriculum. The educational policies in Sudan are determined by the center of power, and it is molded after the northern collective self-fund culture. And it excludes the others who share the country in the marginalized region. And the curriculum itself is designed to produce two categories of people. To produce young people within the center of Sudan who have a strong feeling of their Arab identity and of their position on the top of the social hierarchy in Sudan. At the same time, for the marginalized regions of Sudan like Darfur, the process of education is actually a process of alienation from their own culture and customs and way of living and a kind of assimilation or acculturation into the culture of the dominant northern group. I have very interesting quotations about education in the paper. I refer you to the paper. I started to get conscious about the time, and I wanted to leave you some time for discussion. I don't want to encroach into your discussion time. But the education process is vital, as the DPA is not including the education process to give the people in Darfur the right to design their own education according to their own culture, in order also to reclaim their own history, because the history of Darfur is cut from the educational system, and this is why the process of education for the people of Darfur, I call it a process of alienation from their own culture. They don't know their own history because it's not there. They don't know their own culture, and they were actually made to feel ashamed of their culture, and they were feeling. I spoke about the idea behind the Janjaweed or proxy war. I refer you to the paper to look into that. And also I tried to answer the question of why there was a war among the marginalized. The Arab marginalized tribes in Darfur are marginalized. The Zurga tribes are also marginalized. So why the Arab tribes accepted, or some of them, not all of them of course, accepted to ally with the government, to give the government the Janjaweed militias, and to kill their neighbors instead of looking into the government, central government, as the common enemy who marginalized them all. I mean, I got these statistics about the education among the women, Bagara women of Darfur, as the illiteracy among the women is 100%. So they are really thoroughly marginalized. I tried to find an explanation for why people accept to kill their neighbors and not to see their real enemy. Now I go to the conclusion. It is my thesis that the civil war in Sudan rests comfortably on the rock of racial identity. My project attempts to dig at the deepest roots of the war in Sudan, as a lasting peace cannot be attained without confronting these roots. The deepest root of the war is not political, economic, or developmental. It is rather psychological. Many people, including the insurgents of Darfur, spoke about the politics of marginalization as the cause of the war. This is not the whole truth, however, because the cause of the politics of marginalization is identity. Marginalization is not accidental. It is a conscious policy based on the northern ruling class perception of itself and of the human worth of the marginalized people. Marginalization took place first at the conceptual level before it was translated into action and policies of neglect and exploitation of the marginalized regions and people. All the regions of Sudan, with the possible exception of Khartoum and some parts of Jazeera, are to some degree marginally developed. There are relative differences among them, of course, but the causes of marginalization are not the same in all regions. To be more specific, the northern region, Ashimaliya, where the ruling class comes from, is marginalized. But it is not marginalized for the same reasons that the southern, western, eastern, and eastern regions are marginalized. This is because most of the northern region's population migrated to central Sudan, mainly to Khartoum and Jazeera, where it formed the merchant class for the whole country, and its children controlled the seat of power in Khartoum. In other words, whereas the northern region is marginalized in terms of lack of infrastructure and industry, the people of the region are not marginalized. Those who remained in the region, mainly elderly people, were subsidized by money transfers from their sons and daughters in central Sudan well before people started to migrate to the Gulf. In Sudan, we have a saying that can be translated as, "Those whose hands hold the pen do not find themselves miserable." Meaning that decision makers, of course, do not take decisions against their own interests. Therefore, there is a racial element that adds to the reasons of marginalization of southern, western, and eastern Sudan that is not found among the reasons that led to the marginalization of northern Sudan. The racial dimension is the perception of the ruling class of itself as Arabs, a noble race, and of the other blacks, and of the others as blacks, or Zurga, that is, people of diminished human worth. The roots of the war are visible in the words of one of the victims of that war called Halima, Hikmah, and Hikmah is the name in Arabic means wisdom, who told Hillary Anderson that she heard her attacker saying, "The blacks are slaves. The blacks are stupid. Catch them alive." tie them up, take them away with you. It is also my thesis that the cruelty of the northern ruling class has that the northern ruling class has demonstrated in suppressing the black component of the country is a reflection of its strong desire to eliminate the black component within itself. As I have mentioned in other words, there is a myth and a reality in the north. The myth is that northerners are Arabs, and the reality is that they are Arabized. The myth is that northerners descended from an Arab father and a Nubian mother. The reality is that the vast majority of them are Arabized and Muslim Nubians. Furthermore, northerners identify with their assumed Arab father and exclude and suppress the real Nubian mother. The suppression of the Nubian mother entails the exclusion of the Nubian history and civilization as well. A lasting peace in Sudan will never be achieved without challenging this myth and replacing them with the reality. And without respecting the Nubian mother and restoring her heritage, civilization, and history. Unless Netherlands find their true self, accept it, and live in peace with it, they will never find peace with others. It is my thesis that the wars that Netherlands wage against the black component of the country are an outward projection of the war that they wage against the black component within themselves. The resistance by the marginalized people against the region, the center of power, should be used as a symbol for the resistance inside the northern self. Many northern intellectuals consider the civil war by the marginalized against the center as a wake-up call to the northern collective self. These words are based on identity and should be articulated as such. The DPA's failure to capture this aspect of the roots of the conflict in Darfur simply leaves the disease without treatment and deals only with the symptoms. Therefore, the DPA will remain fragile and the war will intensify, unfortunately. The government and its new ally, Minawi, will try to defeat the NRF and the SLM, you know, is Abdul Wahid faction, while the latter will try to prove its military strength on the ground in order to compel the government of Sudan to review the DPA. Unless the international community changes its soft approach in dealing with Khartoum, and unless it shows some resolve, the war will continue and intensify, promising years of more suffering for the people of Darfur. I stop here and thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Al-Bazi, for your thoughtful and insightful presentation. Before we open it up for questions, I'm just going to launch the first one. And I wonder if your thesis is that if identity were the basis of the peace process, we might see something that was very different. Than what we have in the Darfur Peace Accord. And I wonder if you could talk briefly in terms of process and content about how it might have been different. Maybe focusing on, you didn't go into your discussion of education, but I think education is really a key part of that. And do you see education as a potential area where some sort of supplemental accords might be reached or might be feasible or desirable?
Yes, two main things. If the process included the talk about if it is based on identity, if the problem itself is defined in terms of identity, then definitely it's going to reflect itself in the DPA. Two things would be that. First, the federal system. A genuine and a federal system that is democratic, a real federal system, that will give the people of all the regions, and now we are talking about Darfur, gives the Darfurian people authority over their destiny, over their economy, development, education, culture, so that the people of Darfur will have, first of all, the region as a unified region. Second, they will have control over the resources of Darfur. Third, they would govern themselves, and this is very important because the whole Sudan is being governed centrally from Darfur. And even during the democratic periods that we had, Darfur, the representatives of Darfur mainly did not come from Darfur. They sent them representatives from the north, from the center. So the federal system, and also the basis of the authorities that the Darfurians will have as federal system, they will have control on education and culture. They will develop their education and culture and reclaim their history, and then we will see that the educational system will produce that for them that will stay in that form. I mean, Sharif Hariri is brilliant in outlining how the system of education transfer the Darfurian intellectuals or educated class into an alienated class. They do not, Sharif Hariri in his study said that the majority of the Darfurian educated class, they did not come back to return to Darfur at all. They come totally assimilated in the Nazar culture. They wanted to be Nazarians. They wanted to be part of this structure. And so they lost their brains as well. So he demonstrated that education actually victimizes the people of Darfur. At least if education could produce people who are very proud of themselves, of their culture, of their history, then they will come back to Darfur in order to develop it. So two things, the federal system and control of education, the content of education, and the content of the cultural policies in Darfur, so that Sudan, as a diverse, multicultural country, where every culture would find its expression and develop itself. I hope this is enough.
Why don't we open it up, Abdeslam, and then John?
Thank you, Dr., for this comprehensive critique of the peace agreement. I think you made a very compelling case for taking into consideration identity issues when it comes to international resettlement. My question is one that you raised, but I don't think you really addressed quite fully. I want to give you a chance. I mean, how would the international community go about, you know, taking into account identity issues, especially when they are very, you know, complex? I mean, you mentioned basically your argument, they are psychological, you know, based issues. And is that why, I mean, the international documents, conventions are based on the paradigm of the nation state? I'm just trying to see how do you suggest going about addressing these issues in the international arena?
Just to understand it.
I was just going to ask you to identify yourself for those that
don't. Oh, I understand how you're citizens of peace.
Just to understand the problematic is to exert an effort in getting to the roots of the problem. I know it is complex. I know that even some of the fighters in Darfur, they don't understand it like this. I know that now, for instance, that the DPA was very elaborate in how to increase the number of schools in Darfur. But there is no mention of the content of education. So this means that even the Darfurians, who are on the other side of the negotiating table, they do not understand the problem in this depth. And not all this, the people of who concluded the agreement and signed it, the Minawi's faction, they don't understand it this way. Sharif Hariri did. And he headed the negotiating team for the SLA in the early rounds. He understands it. He is my main resource of understanding how education victimizes the people, centrally made education victimizes the people of that world. So he knows this, and he outlined the solutions. And I'm quite sure, has he been in the process until the end, it will reflect somehow in the documents that we have. Now it didn't. The international community should understand the problem in this way. So you know, unless they, and I observe that so many people from the international community who visited Khartoum, they were really confused. There is this story of Colin Powell when he came to Darfur, and he spoke about the conflict between the Arab and the Africans. And then one of the governors of Darfur, he said to him, "We don't have here Arabs or Africans. You know, we are all Africans, as you can see us. Now, among these people who are with me, can you identify who is African, who is Arab?" And the story was reported in Khartoum newspaper, saying that, well, Colin Powell had his chances, and he started to refer to somebody who said, "This is an Arab," and it turned out to be, no, an African. And he pointed to an African, and he turned out to be an Arab. This is a story. I don't know whether it is accurate or not, but it reflects something very important, is that people will come to Darfur without trying to do a little bit of effort to know who are these people who are going to see. I mean, I had a presentation that I presented to some of the schools and universities, and I put faces from Darfur in a PowerPoint presentation, and I showed people, this is an Arab, this is an African, can you spot something? Sometimes they can see a little bit of difference, sometimes they fail, but an official who is going to go to talk about the problem should understand. To understand that, yes, there are people in Darfur who identify themselves as Arabs. And there are people who identify themselves as not Arabs. So, never mind who the Arabs, how the Arabs look like, they identify themselves as Arabs.
I'm sorry, can I say, but I thought you said that your argument is that the basis for this argument is psychological, that there are no physical feature that can really help determine who is who. I mean, in that case, I mean, how would the international community go about it? I mean, it's psychological dynamic, unless I misunderstood you.
No. The psychological bit is left to us. We will deal with it, not the international community. What we ask the international community to do, okay, is to understand the problem as based on identity. My project is about the psychological bit. I am from the North. I was raised up as an Arab, or to feel as an Arab. I reconstructed my identity. I don't feel I am an Arab. I don't look like an Arab. I'm a Nubian, Arabized and Muslim, and I'm very proud of my heritage and of myself. I just want to multiply my me. Okay, that will resolve the psychological thing.
Okay, I think we've got one there, one in back, there. We'll take those for now. John?
Okay, I'm John Ball at Georgetown. I really think you're making a very important point on the relationship between identity and marginalization, marginalization is not accidental. But one dimension that I know you are aware of, but I think for this kind of discussion also needs to be emphasized, and that marginalization of the non-central areas, the Baghara, Darfur on the one hand and Beja on the other, is also systemic in the political system that independent Sudan inherited from the British. I mean, Darfur was marginal in the British, in the Anglo-Egyptian condominium as well, and that the identity issues that you talk about and the policies that you talk about intensify rather than create the marginalization. And I think then the question that raises for your solution, the emphasis on a federal system, how would and can we avoid creating a federal system that would simply repeat the marginalization? I mean, it isn't automatic that every part of a federal system will have equal power, and a federal arrangement could in fact make it possible for the central government to say, yep, Darfur can take care of itself, and just simply forget about it and intensify rather than mitigate the marginalization. What the British did was they said, yep, you know, Madimbo and those people, they'll just take care of themselves. And so that Darfur was behind the central regions already in 1956. How would your federal system be able to empower the peripheral areas rather than just keeping the central power strong?
Well, simply by giving the people of the region the chance to control their affairs, to develop their region, to define their destiny. I mean, you are right. The historical background is as you described it. That the national governments that inherited the British, they maintain the same marginalization. And this is their short sight, because they didn't have a vision, to correct the legacy of the British. They didn't have a vision to include everybody, to treat everybody as a citizen. They dealt with the state as an organ for their own self development at the expense of the others. The people of Darfur, the people in Eastern Sudan, the people in the South. For instance, we had a president. The CPA is all based on identity. It gave the South full authority and the right to self-determination. That's the highest expression of maintaining your identity. Then you decide for yourself, what do you want? And you determine your own destiny. So now, when the South started to put together their system of education, it is not going to include, for instance, I mentioned this in my paper, Zubair Bashir Rahama, who was a slave trader, who was projected in the national curriculum as a national hero. I mean, this guy, he traded on people who share the country with us. And it is in the curriculum. He is projected as a national hero. And this is by doing that, the national curriculum is dealing a blow and insulting a whole category of people in the South, in the Nuba Mountains, and in the Blue Nile, Southern Blue Nile. These are the areas which used to be the slave field for hunt. So this, I think the federal system, it should be genuine system. Now we have a federal system in Sudan, but it's not a genuine federal system. It is simply a central system. Everything is done in Khartoum, but it is called federal. We call things, by name. That doesn't cost anything, since the whole the reign of power we are held in Khartoum. So what we need is a federal system fashioned after the CPA and the destiny of the South. You want this to be everywhere. And this is why so many people, they think that, you know, instead of dealing with the problems in Sudan in a piecemeal fashion, like here in Darfur, let us, you know, extinguish this and go and then to the east and extinguish that and go to the west. And there are so many time bombs. Now we have the Nuba problem, and we have the Southern Blue Line problem in the case of the South deciding to go for independence. So these people, they expressed their desire and wish not to be part of the North. So we said, why don't we have a comprehensive, really comprehensive peace agreement that deals with the whole problems once and for all? And this, the CPA is capable of doing that if we widen it to include all the other marginalized regions. But it did not, because the government of Sudan didn't work this way.
We have a long list accumulated.
My name is Ibrahim Badawi from Jordan. I would like to actually stick to very few issues. One of them is to try to propose some sort of a reformulated thesis for the population of Durban, which is that I view the situation, the social structure of the Sudanese society, as slightly more complex than what you are thinking. I actually wrote about that and trying to explain why the competitive regimes have managed to prevent the flaring up of civil wars within the North, despite their failings. However, they actually failed to deal with the civil wars between the North and the South. I regard the Sudanese society as some sort of like a complex structure where you have fundamental demand that comes through religion and fundamental culture in the North and South. And then there is an overall diversity that prevents both North and South. And I do think that if we think of it that way, I don't think the identification with the Arabic, with the Arab culture, in the context of being Arabic in Sudan, I think that's appropriate. I don't think it's artificial as you might actually seem to suggest. I think it is a very, very great culture that exists to reflect, I think, the true feeling of the majority of the population, the exceeding majority of the population in the North, simply because it has been historically consolidated by especially the Mahdist revolution, which was substantially dominated and supported by the Kurds and the Western states of Iran and the rest of the region, which produced, of course, very strong national state that has a very strong Islamic identity as well as an Arab identity or Arab national. So I think the reason why, in my opinion, these villages became so hard and created the conditions for civil war in the North are because of the extreme autocracy of the current regime, especially in the South. And I think it is an established fact that when you have a broad cultural identity that has some privileges and then impose on it an extremely autocratic regime that actually depends on a very narrow definition of authorities, such as an Aryan Northern Sudanese case, it is likely to create a kind of conflict. I would not be very supportive to the idea that Arabic culture is something that is relatively official or Aryan or imposed in the North. I think it's extremely well trained. And any other approach to ready to substitute something else, such as an agglomeration of local cultures, I don't think it will be good. I don't think it will actually institute the bond that could actually generate some sort of effect. The second thing I want to say is that actually, as an economist, if you think of the economy of the US, more than 80% of the American GDP is produced by the eastern coast of the United States and the western coast and the all of these red states in the internal domain, in the middle, they constitute less than 20% inclusion. I think a substantial part of the underdevelopment of that form is due to the obvious. Aside, of course, from the deliberate imagination of politics and so on, I think there is an important inherent reason why, for example, the central part of Sudan and the Darien area is more developed than the others, which of course require a different response, which also depends on the right of the constitution, but I think it is also good.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Brahim. First of all, I did not say at all that the Arabic Islamic culture is not ingrained in the North. No, I said that exactly. What I'm contesting and disputing is the claims that the Northerners are Arabs. I said they are Arabized. Arabized means a culture. You know, culturally, they speak Arabic, I do speak Arabic, and religiously they become Muslims. All that I want is for the Northerners to feel that they are Arabized, they have the culture of Arabs. If we feel that, then we will have a different approach and dealing with the Arabic culture itself. We will make it Sudanese. We will Sudanize, indigenize the Arabic culture. We don't take it as a whole set of culture that is produced beyond the borders of our land, and we take it. And I dealt with the issue of these two points that you raised, the economic and the geographical point, in a whole chapter in my book. And I think that I made a case that is not only geography. I dealt with Muhammad Sulaiman's book and how Hawiya and economy and ecology, yeah, ecology and identity. And I made the point that it is not only geography. And I took just one and give you one example. The mechanized farming. When the mechanized farming came, the farms, the areas of the mechanized farming were and still are in the marginalized areas. In the Nuba Mountains, and they are very limited in Darfur, and in eastern Sudan. The mechanized farming, when it started during the Second World War and started by the British, what the British did is that they just distributed the land to the people who live in the areas. They gave them their lots of lands, and they made a very elaborate regulation of how to use the land, how to maintain it, how to develop it, and then the economic, you know, arrangements between the people who were given the land and the owners of the mechanized farm. Immediately after the once the British started to leave in 1955, and the Northern Sudanese started to get to these positions, they changed the mechanized farming. Instead of giving the farms to the people who live and own, traditionally own the land, then the center did what? First of all, they took the land from the people who were being distributed to. And they gave it to people from the north, from the center. And they, instead of giving like 20 acres to a family, then the center distributed very big pieces of land, like thousands of acres, to an individual who will go there. Then the people, instead of owners of the land, they were transformed into cheap labor of the land, their own land. Okay? And then this mechanized farming did not give anything back to the areas. No services, no schools, no clinics, even the zakat, this Islamic religion portion of money that you give to the poor. This, which ordinarily will be given to the people there who live in the area. This, even this money was transferred to Khartoum and to the northern region. And what happened as a result of the mechanized farming is that we destroyed the land of the people because it was, they call it hit and run. I think you call it hit and run type of economy. Okay? And people, other people, they call it predatory economy. Okay? So they destroyed the land. They impoverished more the people. Okay, so it's not only geography, and it's not what all that I was saying is that we in Sudan, in the northern part of Sudan, understand ourselves as not Arabs, as Sudanese. When we say Sudanese, then we accommodated all the others with us. When we say Arab, then we excluded them immediately. And you said this is you mentioned the autocracy and this particular regime, but it's not only this regime. This regime took the things to the extreme. That's right. But these policies of Arabization and Islamization of the other people in the marginalized regions has always been there. All the governments since independence until 1989, when this current government came into power, that was constant. We did not accept the people in these areas as who they are. We wanted them to become copies of the distorted. I called it the distorted image of the northern self through the organ of the state, through the powers of the state. So I agree with you that we are the culture of all that I call for is to Sudanize, to indigenize the Arab culture that we hold, to make it a reflection of ourselves. It's not, now it is not. We don't find ourselves comfortably in the Arab culture because it was the expression of other people. It is how the Arabs look at the world. It's not how the Sudanese look at them. If we become aware of ourselves and conscious of our Sudanese Nubian heritage, then the Arab culture that we will produce, it will become a Sudanese culture and no more Arab culture. Thank you.
We're getting to the end of the session. Al-Bakir, if you'll bear with us for just a couple minutes, maybe what we could do is just take a final round of the questions, and then you can choose briefly to respond, or you can have people come up and continue the conversation afterwards. I understand those of you who have to leave, please feel free to do so.
Yes, my name is Muhammad Saleh. I am a journalist with Ashraf Al-Awsar. That's a newspaper in London. And I'm a Sudanese, and I am from the north. And I have points here, I just want to read them. I look at myself as a Muslim, an Arab, and an African, and my color doesn't have anything to do with my identity. I don't wake up every morning and look at myself in the mirror to see if I'm black or white, or green or yellow or purple. I think color doesn't have anything to do with identity. I think it's a modern civilization. I know this is not a PC, it's a little blonde, but I think there are some nations that are more civilized than other nations. Some parts of the country are more civilized than other parts of the country. I believe the Northern Sudanese are more civilized than the South Sudanese, and they are more civilized than the people in Darfur. I believe Egypt is more civilized than Sudan. I respect Egypt for that. I go to Egypt. I don't feel inferior in the complex. I believe America is more civilized than Egypt. I have been in America for 30 years. I don't have inferior in the complex. I believe white, this is a white civilization. From a black person, it's a white civilization. I have no problem with that. I believe this is a Christian civilization all over the world. As a Muslim, I have no problem with that. I am very glad I am here. I want to enjoy more of this white, this civilization. I want to enjoy more of the Paris civilization in Egypt. I want to enjoy more of the Persian civilization, of the Chinese civilization. My color doesn't have anything to do with my identity. And I think it's an inferiority complex. Some people stand here and say because they're black or green or yellow, they are worse than other people. Thank you.
So, I don't know whether this is a response to my talk or something else, because first of all, the fact that color does not have any property, you don't have any property with color, that's a very good or positive thing. I feel the same. But this is not how the Arab civilization and the Arab culture and the Arab people feel about color. Now, when you say that I am an Arab, this is the bit that I'm going to contest with you. I think this is, and this particular point defines the whole problem in Sudan. If, like Dr. Abrahim, you said, for instance, I take the Arab culture as my culture, that's okay. But in saying I am an Arab, then the Arab themselves will dispute this with you as they did with everybody in the Northern Sudan. People who went to the Gulf, they were not treated as Arabs. The Arabs do not consider you as an Arab. This is a rejection. And in terms of identity, this is going to impact the majority of people. When you feel you are not part of these people, whom you want to be part of, and they reject you, or they put you in a diminished position, then this is going to impact on you. And it is impacting on the Northern Sudanese. I wrote about that, and I enumerated a lot of instances on how they impact on Northern Sudanese. They don't consider when the Arab look at you, they don't consider you as an Arab. They have a problem with the black color. They consider it ugly, and they think that the black color, entails with it. Even at the language level, it refers and symbolizes everything that is corrupt, ugly, and bad. So this is the culture. And when I say that, when we accept ourselves as Sudanese, then we will deal with the culture. I mean this in particular. Then we will purify the Arabic language from all these insulting discourses that are part of the Arab culture. And we produce our own neutral language that does not associate the color black with anything bad, for instance. But now, even if you are following in the Sudanese online discussion group in the internet, there is a comedy in Saudi Arabia, a soap comedy in Saudi Arabian TV, and it makes fun of the Sudanese. And one of the contrasts and the fun that they make is that they got this Sudanese guy. They got, the actor, they just painted him black, and they put him in Sudanese costume, and they put him in a situation where this guy, when he speaks to another person, he says to them, that if that person embarrasses him, he would say to them, "So what was she? You blackened my face. You blackened my face." This is an expression in Arabic culture. It means if you did something shameful, you blacken somebody's face. And they put it as a contrast. Now, a black person who is saying to another person, you blacken my face, and creating this funny situation to entertain the Saudi population. So this is what I am saying. What I'm saying that I don't feel at all an Arab, because when you say an Arab, you speak about innocence. You speak about your features. You speak about not only the culture. And I think the Sudanese, one of the mechanisms that the Northern Sudanese were trying to overcome this, their feeling that they're not part of this, really, part of this world, is that they dissociate between the culture and the race. And would say that, well, Arabism is not a race. It is a culture. It is not. It is a race. There are people who are called the Arabs. They have features. When you look at one, you will identify him. Just as when you look at the Chinese, you identify him. You look at an Arab, you identify him. You look at a Sudanese or Ethiopian, you identify him. And what's wrong with being Sudanese? This is what I'm asking. Why do we want to become something else, somebody else? Why do we want to become Arabs? Why do we find inspiration beyond our borders? This is what I'm saying. As to the terms of development and civilization, I also contest that with you, because I don't think potentially there is any, in the history of Nubia. Nubia built a big and very sophisticated civilization that people still discover every time something new about it. So when you take civilization, you take it when? In terms of history, or in terms of the present, or in terms of what? Potentially, any people are capable of producing a civilization. All people are endowed with the same faculties, the brain, and the heart, and they can produce, if they put it in the circumstances, that would, you know, stability, to flourish, development, and this kind of thing. So you produce your civilization. So the only thing that I am really focusing on is whether the Arabs are a race or not a race, and whether we as a race can fit within that or not. And I made the case that you do not fit comfortably with that, you are not accepted by them, and there is nothing wrong in being ourselves.